It's the Wiggin Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Hello, welcome to the Wiggin Sessions. I'm your host, Addison Wiggin. In this latest installment, I spoke with Byron King, our in-house resource and military expert, plus geopolitical matters. He's also a Harvard-trained geologist who's gotten to know some of the best mining teams on the planet, which involves China, because some of the mining that we're talking about goes on in Africa, right? So that's what we're going to be talking about. So in today's session, we're going to talk about the old right, Bidenomics, which is a thing, rare earths, and of course, your dollars. That's what we do. We talk about your money. So here we go. Let's jam.
So welcome to the Wiggin Sessions. This is Surviving and Thriving in the Post-Pandemic Economy, theoretically. I think we have the Delta variant to worry about. But now we're in episode 53, and we're featuring Byron King, who has been a guest of ours, I think three times now. And the last time was right before the election. So we're going to have a lot to catch up on tonight. What I would like to do is start right off with the old right, because Byron and I have had this conversation like maybe 5 or 10 times. And I'm very interested in this citizen representative, which is what the old right was really about. So Byron, welcome, first of all.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And it, maybe you could just start off with like Thomas Flynn, Garrett, maybe H.L. Mencken kind of overview, and just get us up to like the 50s when they went out of fashion.
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you. We haven't spoken in a long time, and so it's very nice to be back. Second, when we start talking about, you know, like the old right, it was really sort of like the old constitutionalists. These were sort of the residual of, you know, kind of that sort of founding ethic of America that lasted intellectually, you know, into, you know, like the middle of the 20th century. And like you said, it takes it up to about the 1950s. But there were several people who were very, very influential. John T. Flynn, for example, was a terrific thinker and a great, very harsh critic of Franklin Roosevelt for a variety of reasons. I mean, it was just he had no love at all for Roosevelt. Garrett, as you mentioned, much the same thing. Excellent writers. You know, they wrote for very, very prominent.
John Flynn was the editor of the Saturday Post,
which was the
largest circulation at the time.
It was. I mean, it was sort of the national. It was the national news, basically, you know, the Saturday Evening Post. And I mean, today, you know, we have all these networks and we have the internet and it's all sliced and diced and everybody has their favorite little niche or whatever. But way back when, you know, I mean, a magazine like the Saturday Evening Post really controlled a lot of the national narrative. H.L. Mencken, you know, I mean, he's iconic.
In terms of,
these guys came, you know, in a sense to, they were fighting the early decades of progressivism, you know, I mean, you know, the U.S. had evolved from its, you know, colonial days and through the 19th century, you know, you had your Gilded Age, the rise of industrialism, you had the big trusts and everything. And the progressives came along and they said, oh, you know, this is not, you know, the good old days of, you know, yeoman farmers, you know, growing tobacco and corn and wheat, you know, it's a big complex country filled with railroads and telegraphs and complex industries. We need experts to run everything. And you had somebody like, let's go back a little bit further. Let's go to Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was very disdainful of the American Constitution, and in many respects of the colonial sort of American experiment. He thought that the U.S. Constitution and that whole system was an outgrowth of the British monarchy, but it came before the development of the parliamentarian system that you saw in Britain much later. And so he thought that the U.S. was this sort of unformed, unfinished type of governance. And so with his progressivism, he tried to just manage it from the top down. You know, we're going to, you know, with his two terms, we're going to have experts in government doing everything. And Wilson's big thing, you know, what really gave him a grip on the country was World War One, you know, because nothing unites a country like a nice war, right? And so anyhow, out of all this came that wave of post-war progressivism in the 20s, and then with the Great Depression and the crash, in came Roosevelt, who was the understudy of Woodrow Wilson. I mean, Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Wilson's administration. And when I say the Assistant Secretary, he ran the Navy, because the Secretary of the Navy was this guy from North Carolina named Josephus Daniels, who was just a crazy guy who didn't know anything about the Navy. But Franklin Roosevelt ran the Navy, learned a lot from Wilson about how to run things. And then when Roosevelt came into power in the 1930s, I mean, he just started to micromanage the whole country with his, you know, brain trust and these experts that he brought in. And now along come these people like John Flynn, Garrett, H.L. Mencken.
Yeah, their belief was that the representatives in the House mm-hmm. should only be there for a couple of years. And they would have to be beholden to the rules that they passed when they went back home. But now we have a president who's been there for 50 years. Like, what happened to that idea?
Well, you know, in the early days of, you know, the early America, you know, the early 1800s, I mean, for the most part, if you were a member of Congress, you got elected, you went off to Washington, and I mean, then you were days, weeks, or even months away from the home district, depending on, you know, where you were from. I mean, it was sort of you would go off to Washington, and often we say today, gee, it's a shame that the founding fathers didn't put term limits in the Constitution. I say that too. I mean, I wish we had them. I think the thought never crossed their mind, because the idea was that if you're from Massachusetts and you go down to Washington, well, not to Washington, I mean, they didn't have Washington back then, but you go down to Philadelphia to run the country, you're not going to be going back and forth like today. You didn't just jump on the Amtrak, or you don't just jump on, you know, United Airlines and back and forth or something. You didn't have Nancy Pelosi flying back and forth on the Air Force Boeing 757 that she does every week out to her vineyard in Napa Valley, you know. And so they didn't think about it. I mean, it's hard to know what was in their heads at the time. But then along came the 30s, and here is all of a sudden, you know, big government coming along, you know, and really, you know, there was a whole national line of thinking that, you know, this Constitution thing, this capitalism thing, it's a failure. It's failed. We can see it just in the nature of the Great Depression. And, we have to set up all these agencies to run the country. And so this is where many of these alphabet soup agencies came from, you know, the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Power Commission, which is now, you know, FERC, or, you know, I mean, it was just a whole list of alphabet soup agencies. But guys like Garrett, guys like John T. Flynn, H.L. Mencken were there saying, you know, we're taking the rights and the freedoms away from Americans and, you know, from the American citizens. Now the answer to that from the people in Washington and all the brainiacs from the brain trust was, well, those people out there in the hills and the valleys and the factory towns and stuff, they're too dumb to run their own affairs anyhow. So I mean, there was really a definite class distinction going on there. I mean, Karl Marx got a few things right, and one of them had to do with, you know, the stratification of different classes, you know, within a society. And you know, if you just want to bring it to today, I mean, a lot of America's problems today, you know, it's like red state, blue state, this, that, that. No, it's a real class.
It's all bullshit made up by the media, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, when somebody says, oh, it doesn't matter that, you know, that we've deindustrialized the country because, you know, we're just going to take our dollars and, you know, buy things made elsewhere or cheaper. Well, really, I mean, was it really such a good idea to deindustrialize the country and literally put, you know, tens of millions of people, you know, away from their jobs, break entire cultures that took a century to create? I mean, was that such a good idea? You know, and you talk about, here we are, the pandemic, we're a year and a half into it. I mean, I mean, yeah, sure, you know, we've got the vaccines and such that are being made in the U.S., but how much of America's medical supply is made in America? You know, I mean, we've just spent a year and a half. The country's being sick. You know, the country is sick. You know, when if you get the bug, you know, oh, you've got a respirator and you've got tubes and this and that. How many of those plastic tubes are made in America? How many of the face masks are made in America? How many of the PPE, the doctors and the nurses, or how much of that stuff's made in America? Not that much. You know, where's most of it come from? Guess where? You know, I mean, China, but, you know, other places, India too. I mean, we've destroyed the industrial foundation of the country. And that's just on medicines. The pills you take, you know, the antibiotics you take, they're made someplace else. I mean, the aspirin you take is made someplace else. The vitamin C you take is made someplace. It's not made in the United States. If you go to the drugstore and you buy a big jar of vitamin C pills to, you know, get your vitamins, that stuff's all, it's all made in China or India, you know, at least the precursors are. Maybe they put it in a plastic bottle, in a bottling plant in, you know, someplace. But I mean, if you talk about people like Garrett, John Flynn, they were railing against that. And in fact, one of the great lines from John Flynn came in the mid-50s where somebody said, well, Mr. Flynn, you know, what would you do to, you know, to fix what's wrong with the country? And he says, well, we should have a constitutional amendment that says that no Supreme Court ruling since 1934 would have any effect. Something like that. And so sometimes you wonder, it's not such a bad.
He was the editor of the Saturday Evening Post until like 1955 or something. Like, yeah. He was a leading voice in America for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
that entire idea disappeared.
It was swamped. It was just wiped off the face of the earth like a great flood came along. It just subsumed into the intellectual.
I'm from New Hampshire, and I live for your diet. I just believe in independence, and it's just weird to me that the entire concept of people trying to advocate for like rugged individualism has just, I mean, it's gone. So that brings me to one of the leading questions that I have for you today is Bidenomics. Like, this is crazy, right? He's
Bidenomics, been for
50 years, and he's spending trillions of dollars. Like, you and I have had this conversation probably 15 times, right?
Over the years,
How many, they can't just spend their way to prosperity.
You know, the very first thing that we notice about the last, let's say, year and a half, you know, with Trump and with Biden as well, but with Congress, you know, doing what it's been doing. Because, I mean, you know, Trump, Biden, they can't spend any money. Congress spends the money, although, you know, obviously.
Well, they got Pelosi in there, so they're
doing. Yeah, the president can try to guide things.
Actually, I have a question for you about that. Do you think they're going to get voted out?
In the sense that the Democrats will lose the House and Senate? Yeah. I think they ought to. I think there's enough honesty in elections left in enough, you know, counties and precincts of America that they can't cheat their way to victory in all 435, you know, districts. So it'll be tight. It'll be tough.
We know that they can.
It'll be exciting. I mean, in terms of what they deserve to get thrown out on their ear because they've done such a horrible job of, you know, legislating for the country. You know, but in the last year and a half, one thing that we know for sure is that, you know, we've pumped, you know, let's say $6 trillion with a T, you know, $6 trillion into the U.S. economy. And, you know, what do we see for it? Well, you know, okay, we've got some people got their paychecks protected and some companies got their balance sheets protected and, you know, Wall Street inflated and you saw these massive gains in, you know, in stocks that don't have sort of the underlying fundamentals to support them. You know, a lot of people who would have been in deep trouble did, you know, avoid some of that trouble with some of that money. Yeah, but now we've got the whole issue of, you know, there's a workforce shortage in terms of there's a skills gap and a workforce shortage out of it all. And we've got inflation. I mean, just, you know, housing is up, food is up, yeah. Energy
How
is up.
How much do you think the inflation is due to the supply chain? Because I've been trying to figure that out. There's not really an answer right now. But it seems like a lot of the inflation is just a shortage of supply.
Well, there's that, and it's coming at it from both ends, really. I mean,
There's a lot of money flowing around.
There's a shortage of supply because there's a shortage of production. I mean, now one of the things that really did happen with all this money is that, you know, where did much of that supply come from? I mean, it came from overseas. It came from China. I mean, the ships from China are, instead of charging $2,000 or $3,000 for one of those, you know, 40-foot containers, you're charging $20,000 for a container now because they can, because people will pay it, because the demand pull from North America out of Asia is such that those prices have a floor underneath of them. And people I talk to who are in the shipping industry, they tell me this isn't going to go away anytime soon. We're looking at 2 and 3 years of these kinds of, you know, very high prices to move goods across the sea. So there's part of your supply shortage. And
it's happening in every sector of the economy. We're seeing in gas and pharmaceuticals. We're seeing it in basic like vegetables and that kind of thing. Like the prices are going up because the supply is just not there.
Well, you see it in energy, for example. I mean, for an administration that is so down on the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, they're kind of.
Guess what? The price of gasoline is going up, and the price of natural gas is going up. Like LNG cargoes, the liquefied natural gas, are as high as they've been in ever, I think, in years. So I think since 2014, at least. So I could probably go back and check if we wanted to take the time. But yeah, I mean, natural gas is up partly because it's a very hot summer and North America is spinning gas turbines to generate electricity for the air conditioning. But then for people who are watching, you should know that the natural in the summertime traditionally is when the northeastern part of the country, you know, imports gas from the rest of the country and puts it in these big salt caverns and storage caverns underneath. And then you burn that gas in the wintertime to stay warm. Well, the injected gas and the gas storage right now is probably 10 or 12% behind where it ought to be. And looking at gas demand and gas consumption for the rest of the summer, just forecasting the weather, that's pretty safe to forecast. I mean, they're not going to catch up. So not only do we have a natural gas shortage this summer, we're going to have a big natural gas shortage this winter. And that'll
be really a big deal. I remember you writing about that in like maybe 2008 or something, where there was a lag between the supply and the demand.
Right. Right. Yeah. Another angle to that is the Biden administration war, you might say, against fracking and against natural gas production.
And they shut down the pipeline.
And they shut down the Keystone XL pipeline as well. So if you're a natural gas driller in pick a place, Pennsylvania or Ohio, West Virginia, whether or Texas or Colorado, whatever. You know, I mean, you're just not going to put a lot of money into drilling new wells or you know.
Yeah, and why would you?
Why would you? I mean, you're just going to drain down.
Can they even get the employees that they need to do it if they wanted to?
Well, yes and no. We spent the last year and a half, laying people off in the energy industry
across
in general.
The country.
And a lot of these people, when you lay them off for about the fourth or fifth time in their career, they finally just say, oh, the heck with it. I'm going to go find another job. Or, they look at their driver's license and say, oh, my goodness, look at my age. I'm about ready to retire anyhow. I mean, a lot of the people who we were talking about who were going to retire in the last 10 years have started to retire now. I mean, there is we've had this discussion, too, and this goes way back. But there was always this demographic gap in the oil and gas industry because of the 1980s and 90s, a lot of people who were never hired in the first place or who were hired and laid off, they just weren't there, And along came the early 2000s with the oil and gas boom. And there were a lot of people in their late 40s, 50s, and 60s who were doing the work. But right behind them in their lower 40s and 30s and 20s, there weren't. So now there's a whole lot of people in their 60s and even 70s working in the industry. There's not a lot of people in their 40s and 50s. You might call that the prime of a person's career. Then you've got a lot of people in their, say, 30s and even 20s working in the oil and gas industry. But there's this big gap of people. And there's a lot of skills and a lot of knowledge in people who've been in an industry for, 5, 10, 20 years, They're not there. They're not there right now. So Even if we wanted to.
I think that's pretty common across the economy, don't you? Like, there's a bunch of people that are just not working.
That's true. I mean, and you've got your baby boomers who are retiring en masse, you know, just in huge numbers, you know, age 65 and over, or age 66, 67, whatever. And, you know, okay, yeah, sure, maybe they go get a job as a greeter at Walmart or something, but they've left their previous, you know, skill set behind.
Yeah.
And then there's that lag of people. And that you see that everywhere. You see it in aerospace. You see it in defense. You know, I used to write the one of the defense newsletters for Agora. You see it there. One place that has attracted a lot of really smart people over the decades has been finance. You know, a lot. I mean, I hear it from college professors. I hear it from people in industry. And they say, you know, boy, we'd love to get these really smart, you know, math guys or these math guys and gals and stuff. You'd love to get them, but they're all going to Wall Street or they're all going to hedge funds or they're all.
That's been a story for about 30 years now.
Yeah, they all make more. They make more money at it. And meanwhile, you know, I mean, you know, they're not going into manufacturing. They're not going into, you know, basic industry or whatever. And the country, is, you know, like I said, is deindustrialized to the point where we're importing everything we need to deal with the pandemic. You know,
is that a bad thing?
What, importing?
Importing?
It is, in the sense that at some point when somebody decides to, you know, just to turn the valves on you or put the squeeze on you, now you've got a problem. You know, I mean, actually, it was early in the pandemic. A spokesman for the government of China, we could go back and find the exact source if we wanted to look at, actually made the point in a speech that, you know, you Americans, you're beating us up over the pandemic and this and that. If we wanted to, we could shut you off. We could shut all your antibiotics off, you know. Well, that's true. If they wanted to, they could shut our antibiotics off. I mean, it's better to have an economy that actually makes things than it is to have an economy where you've got some central bank on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C., that just kind of emits dollars, emits M1 and M2 into the universe. And then we've been
operating that way for a long time.
We have. And look where it got us. You know, I mean, you know,
every dollar is a piece of debt.
Yeah. I mean, $28 trillion in debt. You know, how much more can you go? You know, I mean, and at some, you know.
No, I thought our limit was $10 trillion, and that was 15 years ago.
I look at it in terms of, like, as a percentage of GDP.
Yeah.
I mean, GDP is a fuzzy number on the best of days. But yeah, when national debt was around 50% of GDP, you would have thought that some wise heads in Washington would have got together and said, geez, we really.
Which ones?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Which ones, you know?
I want to shift gears a little bit, because I know that you studied this a lot too, the petro economy. So there was the petro dollar for many years, but now we've kind of shifted into MMT world, right?
Yes.
So maybe just catch us up on how that happened. So explain first what the petro dollar was, and that replaced the gold.
The Bretton Woods.
Back the Bretton Woods standard. Right. Yep. And then we move forward to today, which is like nobody has written a history on this one yet. But MMT has replaced the petrodollar, really, right?
That's a fair way to put it. You know, it goes back to World War II. I mean, the global monetary economy just broke apart. You know, I mean, everybody's fighting wars and whatever. You know, Europe was destroyed. Soviet Union was destroyed. Asia was destroyed. Japan, China, and the rest of the world was undeveloped. Coming out of the war, you know, there was the Bretton Woods Agreement, named after Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in the White Mountains, which I'm sure you've been there a few times.
Yep.
Beautiful, beautiful old resort. People came together and they basically, you know, finished up a deal that they were working on, that the U.S. promised to back the dollar with against a certain percentage of gold. And then the rest of the world would fix their currencies to the dollar. The dollar would be the North Star, the North Pole Star, whatever. And everybody else would align with it. And we would rebuild world trade when the war ended and the world was destroyed. We had to rebuild the world. Going to take a lot of trade. And so that was fine, you know. And then things worked in the late 40s, the 50s, and even into the 60s. Then came, you know, Lyndon Johnson with, we're going to have guns and butter. We're going to have the great, you know, society and the war on poverty, and we're going to do this Vietnam War thing as well. And so all of a sudden, the U.S. just started, you know, spending like crazy. And actually, it was our dear friend Bill Bonner who told me this story one time, that the soldiers in Vietnam, you know, were spending their money there. A lot of the banks in South Vietnam were affiliated with French banks, you know, because it had been a colony of France. And so all these dollars wound up literally on pallets, just big bags of cash going back to France. And then France was coming to the United States, was saying, here, we've got these millions, billions and billions of dollars that give us gold for them. And so at any rate, in 1971, on August 15th, and actually it's the 50th anniversary coming up in a couple of weeks. Richard Nixon went on television one night, and I remember it. I was there. I watched it. And he said, we're gonna do this and this and that. Now we're going to put wage price controls and this. And
almost sound like it.
Oh, yeah. And so, but one of the things he did was he closed the gold window and said, we're not going to redeem paper dollars, or we're not going to redeem our overseas dollars for gold anymore. And so that threw the world into turmoil. Now, obviously, you know, the sun came up the next morning and people went about their business. It didn't destroy the world overnight, but within a very short time, within months, within a year or so, things were getting way out of hand in terms of, how do we value currencies? I mean, if you're not exchanging it for gold anymore and you're inflating your US dollars, how does everybody else do their thing? Well, that all resolved in out of the Arab-Israeli war in 1973, the Yom Kippur War, where, long story, but in the end, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon worked with the Saudis mainly, but the rest of OPEC as well, and said, listen, you know, if we start kind of keeping our dollar valued against, you know, a barrel of oil in terms of the price of oil, whatever, yeah, that's what will stabilize, you know, global trade. So we kept the dollar, the US dollar, as the world reserve currency, and it was backed up as an item of value against oil, because, I mean, oil is energy, and energy is a way of calculating value.
Do you think that regime is coming to an end?
Yes, certainly the dollar oil regime is. I mean, it lasted through the 70s, obviously, the 80s, into the 90s. You know, obviously, the oil price of oil has gone up and down and up and down. Much of that has to do with availability of oil. Much of that has to do with global economy. But through it all, I mean, if you look at it, the U.S. has just spent money like crazy. If you look at every chart, go to every Federal Reserve chart, every big monetary chart, and you see we're here with big, you know, big, huge debts and big, huge numbers. If you trace it all back, a lot of that stuff all starts to really metastasize in the end of about 1971, 1972, when we went off the gold standard. I mean, it's just been paper after paper written on it. And you can, you know, somebody who does a little bit of their own research can see it. But anyhow, so here we are now today, where we've gone through the whole oil cycle. And obviously, we are where we are. I mean, you know, the U.S. did well with fracking in the last, you know, 10 or 12 years, and, you know, got itself up to about 12 million barrels a day of oil production. That's peak oil for the United States. I don't know where, when, or how we're ever going to, you know, get more than that out of the ground. It's heading down. You know, the last year with the pandemic and the global contraction played havoc on oil prices. Coming out of all that on the other side, the dollar and the petrodollar is not going to have the strength that it used to have. And
so
then
what replaces it? Like what?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, on the one hand, people talk about SDRs, you know, special drawing rights, based on basket of currencies. That's the Jim Rickards approach to it. Yeah, our good friend Jim. And the SDR is going to be a basket of goods, or a basket of currencies and goods, but it will include, you know, there'll be dollars and euros and probably yuan and maybe some yen, maybe some pounds. But there's, you know, I could see a gold component to it and a petro component to it. But whatever it's going to be, the U.S. dollar itself is not going to just be the conductor of the whole global monetary band anymore. You know, it's going to be the U.S. is going to have a tough time just sort of, you know, throwing dollars out into the world willy nilly, without a care in the world of what it means to the purchasing power of
I want to ask you what investors should do, like what you think they should do. But before that, any thoughts on cryptocurrencies? That's been a theme of ours lately.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, right now, I had this talk with Jim Rickards, and we were talking about it. And the world runs on money, obviously, but really the world runs on credit. Yeah. And there is a developed global credit system that's built around real currencies. I mean, dollars, euro, yen, yuan, you know, throw it all in there. There is a developed global credit system that's built around that stuff. I mean, we can talk about, oh, the Chinese want to de-dollarize or the Russians want to de-dollarize. Yeah, they want to de-dollarize and they want to reestablish their currency as the trade vehicle. Got that. But when it comes to cryptos, is there a global credit system in cryptos? And the answer to that is not yet. Not yet. And so
too variable, right?
It's too variable. Yeah. And one of the dangers, one of the real dangers of crypto is that crypto reminds a lot of people of a video game, you know, where people are so used to playing video games and they actually think that, oh, I'm in a video game. I'm actually driving the tank. I'm actually flying the jet. I'm actually carrying, you know, the rifle or something like that. But for a lot of people, video games are real. Well, no, they're not. They're like video games. That's why they call them games. Well, the same thing with crypto. Crypto could really hurt the dollar in terms of, you know, wrecking its credibility as people say, oh, the dollar is terrible. We're going to get out of it, get into crypto. But without a credit system on the other side, how do you run a global economy based on crypto? And the answer is nobody has figured that out yet. Yeah. Now, you might see a cryptocurrency in the sense
of that's the real answer.
Yeah, a crypto yuan or a crypto dollar or crypto euro. Yeah, you might see that. But really, all you're doing is just sort of electronicking, to make a word here. You're turning your current currency into an electronic component. And that's good and it's bad. I mean, if you've got cash dollars, they're not traceable. If you've got electronic dollars, electronic euros, what have you, they are traceable. And so, you know, there goes your financial freedom. I think the idea of moving to a cashless society is along the idea of, you know, the central planners, the ones that Garrett didn't like and John Flynn didn't like. You know, they want to control everything. They want to see every transaction because they want to be able to tax everything. Yeah. And they want to be able to affect your behavior by forcing you to do things using, you know, money and monetary powers.
Let's catch up on rare earths. This is my favorite topic with you.
Rare earths. Here's the answer. This is a piece of some of the highest grade monazite ore in North America. It's from a place called Wichita, British Columbia. You know, right now, something like about 85% of the world's rare earth
still comes from China.
Controlled by China.
Yeah.
And so everything that you think about modern technology and modern electronics, modern everything, is built on and around rare earths. I mean, you know, your iPhone, whatever you have, rare earths. The light bulbs in the, you know, that they put in there, rare earths make the magnets in your electric car. If you have an electric car or car that you will have, the electric car you will have, because that's where we're going. Rare earths, you know. And so there's not enough of them. It's almost impossible to substitute. It's not like you're going to take, I mean, certain elements have certain electronic properties, magnetic properties, whatever. You can't substitute for them. You can't say, well, I'll just use more aluminum. No, you won't. You're not going to build a strong permanent magnet out of anything but certain of these rare earths, you know. Maybe you could use less of them. Maybe you could get away with different ways. But
the question I've been sort of dying to ask you, probably for like 10 years, and I never have. Is that because they just have a big geography? Like they're able to mine it themselves?
Well, they do have big deposits. I mean, we could talk all day about Chinese rare earths and why they're so good at it. They're so good at it because they decided long ago to become good at it.
They'd probably get a lot from Africa as well because they've been making big.
Well, actually, China was self-sufficient in rare earths until fairly recently, although here's what's going on. They're going all over the world, sucking up everything that they can possibly suck up. They're either tying up the mine, the mill, the factory in a place like Africa or South America or whatever, or they're literally buying raw materials literally off the loading dock. Here in the United States, for example, this is something that few people know. There was a very large supply, you might say, of a mineral called monazite that was sitting just unused at a site, and I'll just say in the Southeast United States. And it was in the nature of, I don't know, like 40,000 tons of this stuff just sitting there unused. The Chinese came in and bought it all up and put it on a ship and sent it back to China. Now, are they using it there? I don't know that they're using it right now, but it's part of their stockpile. It's their national stockpile. I've talked to people in the rare earth business who tell me that in the olden days, they used to be able to go to certain miners and certain, you know, sand producers where you can get some of this monazite sand or whatever. And they'd always have a few tons here and a few tons there, whatever. The Chinese are out there buying up every barrel of this stuff they can, every ton they can. They put it on a ship and they send it back to China. So what it's going to take to make the rare earth situation work in the United States is a national commitment of expediting things. I mean, right when people say, well, what about Mountain Pass, California? I say, what about it? They're mining rock, they're putting it in containers, and they're shipping it to China for processing, and it doesn't come back to us. That rock doesn't come back to us. I mean, yeah, sure, the Americans buy, you know, magnetic powders or you know, rare earth powders from China, but it's not the stuff we're sending them from California. It's going to take a national commitment on the part of the US and probably US and Canada to really put something together. There are a couple of ideas out there that are promising. I've mentioned them in one or two newsletters, but I mean, right now I'm not terribly impressed at the progress, at the momentum that we see in the U.S. I mean, it's a problem that people talk about, but nobody's doing anything about it to really resolve it, which you can say about many, many, many other things.
Well, why is that? Is that because there's not a profit margin in rare earths at the moment? Because I think it's going to be a big deal because most of the rare earths go into electronics, right? Yeah. Like all the stuff that we use every day.
Well, it goes into electronics, you know, from your iPhone, your laptop, your cars. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, it goes into weapon systems. I mean, it goes into the rocket nozzles.
So why is it not like a national interest right now?
It is a national interest, but frankly, I just don't see a national program out there to make it work. You know, I mean, if we go back to the 1930s, for example. You can say a lot of bad things about Franklin Roosevelt, and I have, you know, and other people have. But one thing that he did get right was, you know, when he built these big projects in the Tennessee Valley Authority or the Bonneville Power Administration, building dams on the Columbia River, he put people to work. He poured a lot of concrete and steel. He impounded a lot of water and he generated a lot of electricity out of it. Those were great big energy projects. You know, say what you will about it. You know, they came in handy for the last, you know, 75 years, you know, running the country. We've generated a lot of electrons by harnessing that power. I don't see anybody anywhere really with the national vision to do something like that in rare earths. There is nobody in the U.S. who is running a rare earths program the way the Chinese run it, which, okay, that's two different things. But when I say there's nobody doing it here, we do not have an Admiral Rickover running a rare earth program in the United States. And if we did, we would have one, you know, because it's not that hard, but it does take money and it does take a national will.
Yeah, can you compare that to, there's been some political tension over Taiwan and mm-hmm. the chip program there, and the chips obviously right. use rare earths. Can you like put that into perspective?
Sure. Well, about a year ago, it was last July of 2020, now that I think about it, China put sanctions on Lockheed Martin, the big defense contractor, and said, you know, we're sanctioning you because, you know, Lockheed, you're selling weapons to the Taiwan and to the Taiwan military. And, you know, they sold them some torpedoes and, you know, radar systems or something. And so Lockheed wound up on the bad list of China. So China has already, you know, weaponized, you might say, rare earths. Now, if you're Lockheed, you know, okay, there's 16 other ways to get what you need through, you know, whatever. It's not like we're not building F-35s because of what China said. But the point is that China is willing to use the rare earths as a weapon. You know, one of the big issues over, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, how to approach even, you know, talking about Taiwan. You know, is it part of China, not part of China? Is it, you know, is it, how deep into history do you want to go? I mean, they have all these chip fabrication facilities there on Taiwan. You know, how important are they to the whole world? Are they important enough to go to war over? Well, yes and no. If they're important enough to go to war over, maybe we should duplicate them in the United States. We should just, you know, take whatever they're doing and rebuild it here. They said, well, that would cost a lot of money and it's less efficient. And America is a high cost jurisdiction to do business and everything else. Yeah, well, you know, how expensive is it to fight a war with China over something like chips?
Chips run everything. I mean, they run my my boiler that I make my coffee out of.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you've got one of the reasons there's a shortage of new cars is that they can't exactly. build enough new cars because of the chip shortage. There's not enough farm machinery. You think, well, farm machinery? I mean, how hard is it to make a tractor? Well, when you fill your tractor full of chips, you know, if you don't have chips, you
have no tractor.
I mean, companies like John Deere that make ag equipment, they are making certain equipment based on what is available. You know, if the air cargo plane lands and they have certain circuit boards and certain types of, they build a certain kind of machinery. If they need something else and it's not there, well, they're not going to build that machinery anymore. You know, it's an amazing cascade of the industrial food chain that we see at work here. And
all right, so Byron, let's talk about your top picks. You want to give me three? What are you happy about right now?
What am I happy about right now? Well, I will tell you that if you don't have, my view is that if you do not have some, you know, physical metal, you know, that you possess, gold, silver, get some. Don't get all numismatic on me and say, oh, I want to buy a, you know, a old silver dollars. I want to buy old gold coin. No. Just get gold bullion, silver bullion, whether it's the coins, whether it's, you know, little 5 ounce or 10 ounce bars or something like that. Get some of that stuff.
Yeah, you can do that through Hard Asset Alliance too.
Exactly. Our friends at the Hard Asset Alliance will do it. And so that really is one thing to do with your cash. Another angle is that I feel pretty good about, we were talking about earlier about natural gas.
Just in general is.
And energy in general. For as much as the Biden administration is down on, you know, oil and gas, the road ahead for these guys is very strong and very profitable.
Feels to me a little bit like 2003, 2004, when natural gas just took off.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's entire retirement fund was in natural gas at that time.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, why didn't I do that?
Yeah. I mean, even a company like ExxonMobil, you know, I mean, their dividend is absolutely sacrosanct. They're not going to touch it. They've actually done very well in the last 6 months in terms of just, you know, the underlying share price.
Well, you can see gas prices are going up, so it stands to reason, right?
Yeah, and then you know, there are plenty of opportunities in so many sectors of the market, but I like the physical gold, silver, but then the gold miners, the good gold miners are about as underpriced and, you know, low priced as they've been in a long, long time in terms of the big names, you know, Barrick, Newmont, you know, they're always going to do well, you know, in a rising gold market. When you get into the small names, the little explorer companies, whatever, you start to get into serious stock picking. Got some terrific, you know, tiny little ideas that I could talk about, but we can't talk about them to a large audience. You know, just then the intermediate gold companies, you know, Agnico Eagle or, you know, something like that. I mean, they too, although I have to say this, our friends up in Toronto, it's at the Sprott company. They've got the Sprott Gold Miners and the Sprott Junior Gold Miners funds that they run, and beautifully managed, beautifully run funds that, If you don't want to get into stock picking for gold miners, if you don't want to fool around with, like, oh God, you know, I have to read these press releases and stuff like that, let Sprott do all of the you know, the day-to-day management. And you know, Sprott Gold Miners, Sprott Junior Gold are great ideas for parking some money right now while we wait for modern monetary theory to wreck the dollar some more. And you know, as the dollar declines in value, what goes up? Well, hard assets like gold, silver, oil, natural gas, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
All right, Byron, it's always a pleasure.
Okay.
I don't know why I like the rare earths conversation, but I do.
There are a couple of rare earths plays out there. These are small little guys, okay? I'm just going to mention them. This piece of rock comes from a company called Defense Metals. It's a, I don't know, like a 17 cent, 18 cent stock, you know, OTC. But it's fabulous grade, and they're working to drill it up. and get it working. I mean, they're not enough. They're a tiny little junior exploration company. And then there's another one.
Wait, where's that one based?
Defense Metals. They're Vancouver, but they work in their deposits in a place called Wichita, British Columbia. Okay. And there's another one, Appia, APPIA, Appia. And they have fabulous deposit in northern Saskatchewan, which is probably it might be the highest grade ore in the world. We don't know that yet because they're so early in the drilling program. But just because you're an old friend and a dear friend, and you know, be careful. You know, anybody who's listening to this, you know, they say, "Well, what about this company? What about that company?" Yeah, what about them? I'm just telling you that there's two companies that I've been following, Defense Metals and Appia. Then they have some of the best grade in terms of ore that you're going to find in North America. Yes. What happens with it? There's a whole political process, a whole economic process that has to happen to make it work. But it never hurts to have the best ore deposits in North America under your control. So awesome. That's what I think.
All right, buddy. Thanks, buddy.
All righty. Good to be with you. Thank you.
Be sure to follow Byron King's musings in his online newsletter, Whiskey and Gunpowder, something we created many years ago, and Byron's been faithful. It's a good thing. I hope you enjoyed today's session. See you in the next jam.